Thank you, comrades, and thank you for inviting me to speak. And greetings from the socialist and the environmental movement here in Britain. It's been an amazing couple of weeks in terms of mobilisations and wider politics. And what I hope to do today is to do two things. One, to give you a bit of a sense of what the mobilisations have been like in the UK, and also to try and explore where we are at with the COP process. Perhaps a slight correction to your meeting. COP hasn't actually finished. It's not due to finish till tomorrow. But I think we can safely say that there will be very little in terms of concrete. In fact, there will probably be no concrete proposals to deliver any form of climate justice or any form of action on environmental crisis. Before the summit took place, it was very clear at the G20 and in various press conferences that the world's leaders had very little belief that there would be an agreement at COP. In fact, they were talking about having no agreement at all. The first week was marred by rows, particularly between the United States and China about their commitments to environmental action. And the second week has been particularly dominated by a series of statements and lukewarm proposals and press conferences that is, I think have been designed to show that actually something is happening when in reality very, very little concrete is going on behind the scenes. So that's the that's by way of an intro. And of course, the context is the environmental crisis, a crisis that we've seen through 2021, through a pandemic year, where we've seen more fires, more wildfires, more floods, more storms, an intensification of the environmental crisis, and a growing social crisis for literally millions of people around the world. By way of one little example, and because it fits very, very neatly with the theme of climate justice that ran through all the environmental protests that took place in Britain, is a question of Madagascar, where it's gone very little reported in the news, but a drought driven by climate change has caused a famine and a crisis for literally millions of people. And estimates are that up to 1 million people are having to leave their homes because they're short of food. It's an enormous crisis. It barely makes the front pages of the newspapers, but it will become the reality for literally millions of people if there isn't serious action on climate change going forward. Indeed, it already is a reality for many. And I know comrades in Australia will be painfully aware that you're about to enter the wildfire season in the at the end of this year. And there's no doubt that this is going to be an ongoing crisis around the world. The response of the ruling class, the capitalist class, if you like, is COP26. And it's a contested response because, as I said at the top, there is infighting, there is cynicism, and there's a lack of agreement. At the bottom, if you like, across the majority of civil society, I think there is a growing sense of failure and cynicism towards those people who are supposed to be delivering inside the conference chambers and a desire to mobilise and protest around it. That, I think, was reflected by the protests on the 6th of November, on last Saturday, the Global Day of Action. Here in the UK, there were demonstrations in pretty much every town and city, some of them on unprecedented scale. You may have seen the reports that up to 100,000 people marched in Glasgow. Now, that was interesting because the day before, there had been 50,000 people mobilising, and they're mobilising in a particularly interesting way because they joined a call by Greta Thunberg and by trade unions in the city to march for climate justice and in support of a strike that's taking place of actually only several hundred workers, a very small strike in one sense, but very significant in terms of the fact it brought together workers and environmental activists on a 50,000 strong march through the centre of Glasgow, then followed the day after by 100,000. If it had just been that, that would have been impressive mobilisation. But there were 20,000 in London, there were 7,000 in Bristol, there were 3,000 in Liverpool, there were 2,000 in Oxford, there were 1,500 marching in the city where I'm organising here in Manchester. Those are very, very large demonstrations in a time of COVID, in a time when people are coming out of lockdown, not yet confident to take to the streets or take part in big actions together. Nevertheless, these were big demonstrations. And also, and significantly, they weren't just big, they were radical. The COP26 coalition that was formed in Britain to mobilise around the Global Day of Action had a very, very explicit set of politics around the desire for global justice and for climate justice, a recognition of the inequalities in society, a recognition that environmental impacts are disproportionately on the poor, on Black communities, on women, a recognition of the need for solidarity with the indigenous peoples around the world, with the global south, and a recognition that it wasn't going to be a problem solved by the rich global north helping out the poor global south. And this, I think, is very important. I think it's built on the movements that arose around Black Lives Matter, which placed pressure and demanded that questions of historic inequality, racism and colonialism and imperialism were part and parcel of these movements. And I know here in the UK, in my city, Manchester, and elsewhere in the country, the coalitions worked very, very hard to make organisations that were often underrepresented and in protests and communities that were underrepresented, like refugees and migrant organisations, leading parts of those mobilisations. If you look at the pictures of the protest, I think you'll see that that's right, with Indigenous delegations, with anti-racist organisations, refugee groups and so on. The news of the demonstrations, of course, didn't reflect that. Usually the news reflected and photographed the likes of Greta Thunberg and so on. But nonetheless, inside that movement was a very, very clear demand for global justice and a sense of involving the whole world in the fight against the interests represented at COP26. And secondly, and finally on that sense, the sense of actually COP26 not being the answer led, I think, to a much more radical critique of society. It wasn't difficult to engage in conversations about capitalism being the problem, about the need for revolution, about the need for systemic change. In fact, the slogan "system change, not climate change" was everywhere on the demonstrations, and that I think was very inspiring and certainly felt like a step forward on previous similar demonstrations. I've been part of previous mobilizations, as the chair said, not quite for 30 years, but I've certainly been part of protests at the COP talks in Paris, COP talks in Copenhagen, previous demonstrations. And those were always marked by a sense of people hoping, praying almost, begging those talks to deliver answers and solutions. In actual fact, the demonstrations now felt much more like us demanding action from the rulers, and a sense of if they didn't deliver, we would fight for transformation. So let's turn to COP itself, because as I said at the beginning, it seems to me very unlikely that COP26 will deliver any sort of solutions. In fact, the draft text of the agreement that was released on Wednesday morning is quite shocking in its cynicism. It has no mention of fossil fuels, no mention of coal, oil, gas. It's a general set of statements and platitudes that don't really offer any concrete way forward. It's full of saying nice things and good things. And this is similar to the phrases and the statements coming out of many of the leading speakers at COP. And I think that we have to understand the COP process itself, which began in the early 1990s with the United Nations Earth Summit in Rio in 1992, as being a very specific thing. As I said at the start, it's the capitalist class's response to climate change, to environmental crisis in general, but in climate crisis in particular. And thus, it has always attempted, if you like, in part of its DNA inside the COP, is a sense that actually capitalism is the only way to do things, and that capitalism is the solution to the climate crisis. And it's very interesting to see in almost real time at Glasgow the way that people are articulating this, both at the top in the keynote speeches and also in other statements from politicians and so on. Mark Carney, who is the former governor of the Bank in England and is now the United Nations Special Envoy on Climate Finance, of all things, Mark Carney made a speech at COP where he said that finance is the window through which ambitious climate action can deliver a sustainable future. Now, among other things, Mark Carney is also a representative of a new organisation called GFANS, the the Glasgow Finance Alliance for Net Zero, which includes organisations like the Bank of England, the London Stock Exchange, big banks, big financial institutions and so on. And they have an explicit agenda of driving through the argument that finance, that capitalism itself is the solution to climate change. This isn't new at COP26. It's part and parcel, the very DNA of COP that stretches back all the way back to those agreements signed in the early 1990s in places like Rio, Kyoto, and so on. It's the sense that you can only solve climate change if you make nature part of the market system itself. You turn nature into a commodity that can be bought, can be sold, can be traded, and you try and reduce pollution by giving pollution a price on the market. And this is why you see such emphasis on things like carbon taxes, on emissions trading schemes, on carbon trading schemes, and so on. And the problem for us, the problem for millions of people, the problem for people facing wildfires and floods is that these schemes don't work. They don't work because they don't reduce emissions. They give companies and countries an opportunity to pretend they're reducing emissions by offsetting them on some financial scale somewhere in the world. There are other problems with COP, and they shouldn't be neglected. The driving theme, as I said, is this sense of finance and capitalism being the solution. But there are other problems. Part of those problems come from the people who are at COP. The wealthy, powerful nations from the global north, in particular the United States, but now also the BRICS countries, China, Brazil, and so on, have particular agendas influenced by their own international interests that they will try and push. In the pamphlet I wrote just before COP, for the Socialist Workers Party here, which comrades can download from our website, I go through some of what this meant in practice at previous COPs, where powerful nations would lean on smaller, less developed countries to argue that they shouldn't push particular agendas or to tone down their demands from the wealth. And this leads, of course, to the weakening of any agreements made, but also, crucially, to the undermining of attempts to support the Global South in terms of its own development in a sustainable path. That's why we've seen big, big arguments in the run-up to COP26 and in the conference in the last fortnight around whether or not and how to deliver the $100 billion of international finance that's been promised to the Global South. If you read some of the press releases, they give the impression that this is a new, wonderful thing that's been thought up. But this has been contested going back to the Copenhagen COP when Obama was president. And the other people at a COP who have strong influence are the corporate interests themselves. And we'll focus just for a few minutes on the fossil fuel interests. The biggest single delegation at COP in Glasgow is of 503 people from lobbyists from coal, oil and gas corporations. They represent 100 different countries. They're, in terms of a comparison to the number of delegates from the indigenous communities around the world, they outnumber them about 2 to 1. And they come with a particular agenda, not explicitly, they're not that stupid as saying coal or gas oil is the only solution. But they come with an agenda of pushing finance policies that are friendly to coal, particularly, as I said, things like carbon trading and emissions trading schemes and so on. And crucially and frighteningly, many of them are part of countries' own delegations. And I'm sure Irina will talk about this, but Scott Morrison has a particular criminal record in this regard because he's bought a number of fossil fuel corporations from Australia to lobby for things like carbon capture at COP. And so what we really have is an event that's distorted, as I said, by its emphasis on the capitalist solutions to climate crisis, and distorted internally by the nature of capitalism in the 21st century, where a tiny number of powerful countries dominate the globe and push for their own particular imperial interests around the world. Ideologically, this manifests itself in them telling us that everything is going to be fine. They wheel out some of the politicians to greenwash themselves and to give a sense that things are okay. And I don't think the movement buys it. In fact, I think what's interesting about COP26 is that they're clearly worried by the movement. There was a big keynote speech a couple of days ago by the former US President Obama, who basically welcomed the protest and celebrated the involvement of young people and basically said to them that we have to do something to help and go forward together and urge people to participate in democracy and elections and so on. Yet Dan, well, it completely ignored his despicable personal record in destroying previous COP agreements and encouraging the use of fossil fuels. But a real sense of them using Obama to draw in the young people and to make them feel part of a process that's doing concrete actions. More importantly, and more interestingly, I think they're very, very aware of what the movement themselves represented. I mentioned Mark Carney, the UN's special envoy on climate finance. I have to say that several times because it sounds so ridiculous. Special envoy on climate finance. What on earth does that mean? Mark Carney made a speech which the UN has trumpeted on its own website, where he says that the money is there, we will solve it, paraphrase slightly, this is not blah, blah, blah. They're consciously defending themselves against the word of Greta Thunberg, the young woman who has led the protest. Yet they feel so on the defensive that they have to take on her argument, which says to me that in a sense we are winning. We're not winning in their terms because we aren't forcing COP to deliver, but we are winning in the sense that we're delivering a radical movement on the streets that can start to challenge these policies. Now, I think in the last sort of 5 minutes or so of my talk, I think it is worth us exploring how COP isn't an aberration. It's a manifestation of the real interests of the capitalist system placed into a conference centre. I'm sure comrades who've engaged with socialist debates around the environment will be aware of the argument that comes from Marx's work and has been developed by other Marxists, that capitalism is a system driven by the profit motive, by the sense of needing to accumulate wealth for the sake of accumulation, can never itself be greened. Built into the nature of capitalism is the systematic degradation of the environment, of natural resources, and of people in the interest of making profit. And that cannot be fixed. You cannot square the circle, so to speak, and transform capitalism's very nature through a series of agreements in the conference chambers. And I think that's why they're scared, because they know that after 26 years, there has been no action from climate change. And they know that the environmental movement is now spilling over into a much wider social movement that is demanding all sorts of injustices be fixed. The question of colonialism and imperialism and refugees and racism and indigenous rights that we've talked about, but also questions of jobs and work and how we live our lives and the inequalities in society more generally. And these are coming together, and that threatens actually quite an ideological crisis for those at the top of the society. It's made worse, of course, by people like Boris Johnson, the ridiculous Prime Minister of Great Britain, who can fly to and from COP in his private jet and seemingly dismiss stuff. More serious politicians at COP are quite worried, I think, about what's going on and their inability to find a solution, which is why they've gone to great lengths overnight to do a press conference with China and America to talk and promise that they're doing something, even though they haven't got anything concrete to point to and to say this is what we're doing. So which brings me to the final point about how revolutionaries and socialists must be part and parcel and organising this, because as I said, I think it's a growing radical movement, a movement that is taking up all sorts of wider political issues. And I think that's fertile ground for those of us who argue that capitalism cannot solve the crisis, that we need system change, we need revolutionary change, we need socialist change to deliver a sustainable world, because we need to change the mode of production. We need to change the way the economy is organised and rationally organize our relationship with the natural world in the interests of the wider planet and the people who live in there. And I think the first thing, and it's very clear that comrades and yourselves have been part of these movements, and that's important, raising radical ideas, pushing for the involvement of the widest possible numbers and groups of individuals and so on. I also think that the other thing we're doing is to try and show how these issues become important to the wider working class through questions of just transition. And here, the question of climate jobs, which we've just relaunched a new edition of our pamphlet around, to show that an environment, a sustainable world, is one where workers can have decent, unionised, well-paid, sustainable sustainable jobs, at the same time as leading an argument that says the working class are the agent for change. It's the workers who create profit in society. It's the workers who are central to the capitalist economy. They're the ones who can bring it to a halt. And not just that, workers have the power and potential to create a totally new way of organising society, one where ordinary people democratically plan collectively production, not in the interest of profit, not in the interest of short-term accumulation, but in the interest of a rational way of organising society that is better for all of us. And I think it's worth us celebrating, if you like, a little bit, the socialist contribution to this, because I think when people say system change, not climate change, when young people write that on their banners, it's a radical solution that represents their hatred of capitalism, a system that impoverishes and destroys. But there isn't necessarily a thought through alternative, and we can offer that. We can offer, based on the historic struggles of revolutionaries from the Paris Commune and the Russian Revolution through to Sudanese workers today, a sense of workers creating and having the power to change society and creating a new society from bottom up. And that's something I think that revolutionary socialists have a lot to offer. And if I'd finish on one single point, if we are to succeed in the short time that we have left, the bigger, stronger revolutionary socialist organisation is on the ground, in workplaces, in trade union branches, in colleges and on a council estates and so on, then the more successful we're likely to be. And so I hope comrades here who aren't members of it will get involved and be part of building that future, that radical future. Thank you very much, and greetings again from Britain.
Thanks so much, Martin. That was fantastic and amazing to see the connections overseas, particularly, as you said, you know, it's going to be the movement that we're building both over there and here that's going to bring the system to its knees. So, it's especially valuable to hear from comrades like yourself overseas. So next I'll hand over to Erima.
Thanks so much, Martin. It's really good to hear how things are going over the other side of the world, seeing all those demonstrations, having our demonstration on the weekends, coming out of lockdown and having everyone here in the room today is very inspiring. And I think, it's all systems go now. Reports from COP are that from the pledges made so far for 2030, that still leaves the world on track to hit about 2.4 degrees Celsius. That comes from a group climate action tracker. So, you know, despite COP being presented as, you know, the last chance of the solution, we're still headed to climate disaster. And the Australian Scott Morrison government played a particularly shameful role at the international conference, you know, first almost refusing to even attend Glasgow, refusing to update Australia's targets, 2030 targets from Paris, despite the likelihood that we'll overshoot those targets anyway, and then even opposing a draft clause that allows countries another year to update their 2030 targets if they haven't already and announce them in 2022. We didn't even want to see that clause in the draft. Australia wouldn't sign up to a pledge to cut methane emissions, which is for people who don't know, like a particularly potent greenhouse gas and one that often leaks around the edges of gas wells. He also opposed a clause which calls on nations to speed up the ultimate phasing out of coal and fossil fuels. And Angus Taylor, the Orwellian named Minister for Energy and Emissions Reduction, in the lead up to COP said that the government could use the summit to actually promote Australia as a good and reliable place to invest in gas and carbon capture and storage facilities in the future. And reports that the Australian Pavilion at Glasgow, the most prominent feature of that is the gas giant Santos promoting their plans and lobbying for future carbon capture and storage facilities. People might have heard Morrison's gaffe that he made. It seems somehow a little bit more strategic than that, that the world is building momentum to tackle China, he said, instead of quickly correcting himself, he meant climate change. The world's building momentum to tackle climate change. But I think that shows actually exactly who Morrison thinks the real enemy is at a conference like that. And it goes a long way to showing, you know, the logic of these conferences and the and this capitalist system of global rivalries, where, you know, in order to take international action, we're up against all this kind of international competition, where no country wants to, you know, allow another country to have the advantage. They don't want them to have access to the resources, access to the, you know, cheap electricity or, you know, oil for military power and spending. And so much of the publicity that we got in Australia from Glasgow in the first week was taken up by the really disgusting spat between France and Australia over some supposed lack of honesty and integrity in the nuclear subs deal, as if, you know, you can have an honourable way of populating the planet with more weapons of mass destruction that are, you know, designed to kill hundreds of thousands of people. Morrison's plan for net zero by 2050 is an absolute joke. It was adopted really just to avoid complete embarrassment at COP. It was basically the minimum requirement of even attending. And there are no new policies or funding. It relies primarily on a kind of fantasy of technological breakthroughs in the future. And a lot of that really is code for carbon capture and storage becoming feasible. Even the Financial Review called the plan a prayer, not a plan. And of the $20 billion claimed to be spent on low emissions technology, that money has actually already existed in the government's earlier technology roadmap plan. And half of that you can date back to the Clean Energy Finance Corporation set up in 2013 under the last Labor government. I think as well, it's the degree to which Morrison is pushing the carbon capture storage is significant, because it really is about saying, when he says technology, you know, he's not talking about solar and wind and all this incredible technology we already have. He's talking about a technology that allows us to keep burning fossil fuels. That's, you know, that's his vision. And carbon capture and storage is incredibly expensive. It's basically unproven. There's one plant that works a little bit some of the time in one place in Australia, but pretty much every you know, politician report, etc., like, acknowledges that it's not yet feasible. And of course, you know, we end up still with all this toxic pollution that's being stored in the planet. It's not renewable. I think the kind of period that we're in now, like, we're seeing the way that technology is becoming Morrison's new code word for leaving things up to the free market. And you can see it in that slogan of technology, not taxes. That's how he's differentiating himself from the Labor government. But I think we have to puncture this hypocrisy, because the Liberal government, the champions of the free market, broke all their promises and expectations by spending, you know, a huge sum during the COVID lockdowns, breaking all their promises of budget surplus. And so they should have, you know, we welcomed that spending. I mean, some of it more than other parts of it. But it shows that absolutely they can spend money when they want to, when they're willing to, when they feel that the pressure and the necessity is there. They're spending over $100 billion on nuclear submarines, which threaten war with China. And they're spending $600 million of public money to actually build, like, publicly build and own a gas-fired power station at Kurri Kurri. So when they want to spend the money, they can. And yet, as I said, the incredible technologies that do exist are not getting a look in. As, you know, a member of the MUA, I've been following and participating in the offshore wind campaign. There's huge potential in Australia for a massive offshore wind industry. And offshore wind is quite unique in that, you know, you can build it so much bigger than onshore. It can provide, like, serious baseload power. And the sites that have been identified line up quite neatly in a lot of states with the very towns, like the areas around the Hunter, the Latrobe Valley, where, you know, those communities have historically relied on fossil fuels, where people need the transition. So it's, you know, it's a perfect industry to fight for a just transition for workers. But I think despite this technology, as well as solar, hydro, you know, green hydrogen getting cheaper, it's a mistake to think that it's simply going to displace fossil fuels on the scale or in the time needed to avert disaster if it's left up to the market. And I think that's one of, you know, the questions we have to sort of tackle as part of this question, you know, can capitalism deliver? Like, it is true that, you know, if you're talking just with a blank slate, it's becoming cheaper to invest in renewables rather than new fossil fuels. But the fact of the matter is there's 100 fossil fuel developments in the pipeline in Australia right now that, you know, if burned, would result in nearly 1.7 billion tonnes of greenhouse gases, which is 5% of global emissions. And there are, you know, coal companies right now predicting for massive increases in production next year. And I think that's why the net zero target is, you know, a farce and a danger. Because it is, whilst it's true that a small amount of leftover CO2, perhaps in industries where, you know, there really is no feasible alternative, like right at the moment, can be absorbed in carbon sinks like forests, you simply cannot offset your way to zero when you're talking about carbon that's been stored in the ground for millions of years with, you know, with tree plantations. And I thought Martin actually addressed this really well in his pamphlet, where he talks about, you know, the way that plantations, you know, burn down, they die, they don't replace the kind of deep kind of ecosystems of forests and so on. You can't offset that. We actually have to keep the carbon in the ground and stop burning it. So that all paints, you know, a pretty bleak picture and a reality of what we're up against. But whilst delay, I think, is the new denialism, the debate has shifted in our favour, and we should recognise that. It's obvious that the Liberals can no longer campaign on an outright refusal to act. You saw Morrison this week posing in marginal seats in Victoria, charging up an electric vehicle, whereas just one election ago, Michaela Cash was promising to save tradies' utes. The Murdoch papers, you know, decades of just outright denialism, you know, throwing doubt on the science, are now running a campaign for Mission Net Zero, where they say that Australia can be green and gold. And whilst it's our job to expose all this cynical greenwashing, we also can take advantage of the rhetoric, because the debate is no longer if we should act. It's with what measures and how fast. And there's actually 10 existing coal-fired power stations that are set to close around Australia in the next 10 years. So it won't be us, you know, throwing people out of work. It'll be the fossil fuel industry leaving people behind, leaving ghost mines behind them. And, you know, this is already like a very, very real question in The Hunter, where, you know, Morrison's answer is the Kurri Kurri gas-fired power station, but that's only going to produce 10 ongoing jobs. You know, we can come in with the answers that are needed. I saw a news report on Channel 9 of some of the global protests, and it ended with some shots of our rally in Sydney, and said that the rally was demanding 100% publicly owned renewable energy by 2030. And I thought that's pretty damn good to get on Channel 9. You know, it's clear, direct, it cuts against Morrison's attempts at fear-mongering over job losses. And then I watched Chris Bowen on Inside, and you know, it was just so obvious that the Labor opposition, you know, they still won't come out strongly for investment, for just build it, you know, for creating jobs, for taxing the rich. They, you know, sort of bleed about, oh, we've got a whole suite of policies. We've got so many more policies than Morrison. And yet, you know, they're hedging their bets. On the one hand, they're saying there'll be no new coal-fired power stations under Labor. On the other, they don't want to phase out coal. They're actually backing Morrison in not signing the pledges to cut methane or phase out coal at COP. They say CCS, the carbon capture storage, could play a role. Carbon credits can play a role. They just shouldn't play like the central role. And the problem is that Morrison's, you know, diverting the money. Like, it's confusing. It's uninspiring. And I think, you know, most to the point, they are not sending a clear message that working people are going to be at the centre of any transition. And that's why, you know, when we fight for not just climate action, but climate justice. Like, we want to fight for a world that's better than the world we've got now, where, you know, everyone has a job, where there's awesome public transport that works and is reliable, and, you know, so on and so forth. And those are the kind of messages we need, and the messages that I think can actually win people to the movement. And it's just going to end on the movement, because I think solidarity has played a really pivotal role for a long time, for many years, but also particularly in the last 2 years, building the climate movement we need, bringing, you know, union contingents to the student strikes, organizing campuses and workplaces to go out on strike for climate action, getting a sign-on statement of hundreds of trade unionists against the gas-fired recovery, and engaging with Indigenous activists fighting Santos going into the Narrabri and bringing that fight to the cities. And that kind of, you know, climate of radicalism and resistance that we've created, you know, within that, the ETU, you know, has got the confidence, the Electrical Trades Union, to flag a potential green ban of its members working to on the site to build the gas pipeline and Santos's plant in the Narrabri. And that's the kind of workers' power that will be the absolute, you know, key to actually slamming the brakes on the fossil fuel madness. We may be up against, you know, the biggest, dirtiest corporations in the world, but even they rely on workers to build their plants, you know, and dig up their profits. And organized labor can refuse to build these destructive projects and fight for meaningful, sustainable work that benefits humanity. And we've seen that, you know, historically in the green bans in the 70s in Australia. The rally on the weekend, you know, it wasn't huge, but we're coming out of lockdown. I think it was very significant for what it was, because, you know, it was, you could see all the organized groups. We had contingents of, you know, First Nations, Pacific Islanders, students, a lot of different unions, NGOs, church groups even. And I think, you know, from here we can build to try to get back to the numbers that we had in 2019 with the student strikes. So going into, you know, the federal election next year, climate will be a big issue. And I think we'll see much of the usual push around door knocking, marginal seats, campaigning, and so on. But the key thing for us coming out of lockdown and into the election will be to build a movement that cannot be put in its box, whoever wins the election, and can build that kind of united power and class power that, you know, can take on capitalism and can win the action we need in the time that we have.
Thanks, Tilly. Thanks, comrades. It's really interesting to hear the experience of activists there and the politics that you're facing, and to see the parallels and actually the differences. And actually, I do think it is important to see Scott Morrison as a particular playing a particular role in COP26, of someone who is very clearly arguing a position of a section of the capitalist class, which is that actually we do want to carry on doing what we're doing and to try and use technological innovation and solutions to solve that. He's very explicit around that, around carbon capture and fossil fuels. And I think he reflects one of the dominant strands of thinking around the world, though many other proponents are far more liberal. If you think about, say, Bill Gates, who articulates a very similar position around, say, nuclear power or electric vehicles and so on. But I wanted to make some more general points that arose out of the discussion. I was struck by a point that I think the first contributor, Angus, made, which is that what COP says and what shows is the failure of a strategy of reform on an international scale. And it does pose the question of reform or revolution for us. I think that's absolutely right. And I won't go over again why COP26 fails, but I do want to draw out some of the points around the nature of capitalism itself. And I think it's really important, the points that comrades have made around the question of the military. I think two contributions, I'm afraid I didn't hear the comrades' names, make the point about the way that the military machine internationally, and obviously in different international nation states, is part of the climate problem itself. I mean, the US military is, I think it's the single biggest institutional user of fossil fuels in the world. The military itself globally is responsible for 5 or 6% of global global missions. The US military is clearly the biggest problem for it. The US military, if it was classed as a country on its own, would be something like the 47th biggest emitter of gases in the world. And as the comrades say, those figures are completely excluded from any international agreements. They were excluded from the Paris Agreement. They're not part of the discussions on the table at COP26. And I think it's interesting to ask why, because it isn't simply that they want to cover up what they're doing, or they want to hide how inefficient their aeroplanes are, or any of that stuff. It's because actually the military is a central part of the capitalist system itself. And it's a central part in the context of climate change. They know that there will be wars that arise in the future over questions of access to natural resources, questions of access to water, the question of people fleeing their countries. And they want to be able to use the military to protect and push their national interests wherever they are. And it's clear that Scott Morrison, as Comrade said, in terms of the debates and arguments with China, wants to bulk that up and build that up. And it's important that we highlight the problem of military emissions. It's not enough. We can't simply pretend that we can get rid of the military, or we can disarm the world and reduce the emissions from that sector of society, because that would be utterly impossible in the context of capitalism itself. And it brings to mind different aspects of capitalism. I mean, I was reading the other day about the advertising industry in the UK. Now, the advertising industry is fascinating because it's an enormous producer of waste, of inefficiency in society, and emissions itself. Britain spent something like £23 billion on the advertising industry in 2020 alone. It's a figure that's expected to go up by about 15% this year. It's a colossal waste of money, and it represents a colossal waste of energy, natural resources, and a colossal production of emissions. And there are lots of campaigns and people who say, let's have less advertising, let's have lesser billboards and all the rest of it. What they miss, of course, is, like the military, the advertising industry is absolutely central to what capitalism does. It's about pushing and driving a model of production and consumption, which is based ultimately on the constant innovation and production of new commodities that can be bought and sold for profit. Most of those commodities are utterly pointless, utterly useless. The new iPhone 13 with its screen that can't be released, designed entirely to make people who bought iPhone 12s or iPhone 11s buy the new iPhone. So the problem, I suppose, I'm trying to come to is that the nature of capitalism itself, wasteful, inefficient, pointless in whole aspects of its existence, but cannot break from that model of operating. And we know what the flip side is. Think about how in Britain, £23 billion a year could be spent to improve people's lives, to improve wages, to give people jobs, to improve their healthcare, to improve their education, to improve their housing. And of course it isn't. It's shifted to sell things like iPhones and cars that nobody really needs. And this is why I think it's important that socialists, as the comrades in the room have done today, articulate that alternative, that actually we can do things differently. We can build our cities, build our homes differently. We can organise our lives differently. We have better healthcare, better jobs, and so on, in a socially in a sustainable way, but also in a way that improves the lives of workers. But I think we also have to go further, because once you start demanding those things, you come up, as Judy said on the in her contribution, about the question of the capitalist state, because the capitalist state isn't going to do it. It's not a neutral body that sits there above society, arbitrating between different forces. It's there to push the agenda of the capitalist class. And the comrade who spoke about the way that the capitalist system has become a fossil fuel system is absolutely right, and they're right to push and emphasise that this is about them maximising their profits historically, and a particular model of production. I'd highly recommend Andreas Malm's book Fossil Capital for an exploration of why this happens and why it does it. The capitalist state is going to have to be challenged and broken if we want to have a sustainable world. If we want to see that money that's wasted diverted towards the interests of working people, then actually we're going to have to fight the capitalist state. And that poses a very, very sharp question for socialists, and indeed for the wider environmental movement, about what sort of movement we need. And I think socialists have to pose a question of workers' power as a counter to capitalist destruction. It's a very, very real demand in the here and now. I'll finish with an important point. I heard a comrade made a point the other day. He says, it's in the old days, the socialists used to talk about the choice between facing humanity as being between socialism and barbarism. But in climate crisis terms, barbarism is already here. Those million people in Madagascar who haven't got food and face famine and drought, that 85% of the world today faces climate change as a reality, as a lived reality, not as something that's going to happen in the future. And this is true in the poor nations, in the global south, also true in the rich nations. One third of Americans over this summer experienced in their county a climate disaster of one form or the other. 64% of Americans faced a multi-day heat wave in the last year. The reality of climate change is here. It's barbarism for people because it will badly affect millions of people, the poorest, communities of colour, and so on. The choice facing humanity now is socialism or extinction. If we don't deal with the climate crisis, if we don't get rid of the system that is driving the destruction of the natural world and the destruction of the people who live on this planet, we will face extinction on a truly horrific, horrific scale. And that means that the demand for socialism has to be one that we're fighting for and breathing as part of our wider fights for better healthcare, better education, for climate jobs, for a sustainable economy in the here and now. We have to constantly raise the red flag of socialism and say, if we want to have a future, millions of people around the world have to be fighting for this as an alternative, because the capitalists will never deliver it. And that is the tragic lesson of COP26. Thank you very much, comrades.
I'd like to follow. Thanks so much, Martin. And thanks everyone for the discussion. I just wanted to take my summing up to elaborate a little bit, because, you know, I mentioned and a lot of people mentioned at the front that we really do push for this demand of publicly owned renewable energy. But I think that it's worth just spelling out a little bit more, like public ownership and government investment. You know, that's not a revolutionary demand. It's not, you know, anti-capitalist per se, but I think it's interesting that it's only revolutionaries and some trade unionists that have actually are raising that demand, and might go to Caitlin's point that, you know, revolutionaries, I think, make the best climate activists. And I think there's a couple of reasons we argue for that. One is that it is the most straightforward way to actually tackle the crisis in the time we have. You look back over the last couple of years of COVID, you see how much governments can actually intervene. You know, these whole sectors are shut down, flights grounded, you know, borders shut, money like moved around, you know, you workers, not you're staying home now. Like, and you know, in a lot of ways, a lot of those measures were very draconian, they were cruel, they left people you know, with no income or separated from their families. But nonetheless, you could see the way the government could intervene and just reshape the economy overnight. There is absolutely no reason that they cannot do that with climate change. We don't need some complicated, you know, mechanism of carbon trading and carbon credits and wait for the market to do this and offset it over here with some dodgy scheme in, you know, exploiting Indonesian farmers. Actually, they could announce, like, tomorrow we are going to build, you know, an offshore wind farm off the coast of Hunter, a mass solar plant at Port Augusta. It's going to create this many jobs. We're going to retrain these people. It's going to be on this time scale. We'll redeploy you. We'll offer early retirement benefits to people that want to retire early. We'll, you know, transfer everyone else over on the same wages and the same conditions. Like, we can actually take control of the energy system in that way. And I think the, you know, what flows from that is we are not for saying that it, you know, to leave it up to the market, to leave, you know, the climate up to the market, because we don't think it'll deliver, but also not to leave workers up to the whims of the market. You know, we want to make sure that no one is left behind. We know that people have experienced decades of privatization, of cutbacks, of job losses, just again, another, you know, huge amounts of job losses just in the last couple of years. We're not for saying, you know, well, I hope you win something out of it. It doesn't help to tell, you know, a fossil fuel worker in Newcastle, oh, that's all right, there's going to be, you know, 1,000 jobs on a solar farm in Dubbo, unless, you know, you can actually match those jobs with those people. You're going to get a huge backlash. it's actually going to embolden the right and embolden Morrison, you know, I'm the champion of jobs, you know, when if people see that what climate action means is then being thrown on the scrap heap and forgotten. So we're not for them. And I think public ownership, you know, it's not as far as we want to go, but it's a little microcosm of the kind of way that we want to take control of society, take control of planning, you know, make sure that, you know, we're not building, you know, solar on Indigenous lands, for example, against the wishes of those communities. I think Anna made a really good point at the rally. Like, you can't net zero your way out of, you know, Santos destroying Gamilaroi lands and the significance of that. It's not, you know, just an input-output system. We actually have to respect, you know, all the particularities of the world we live in. And the way that we as socialists ultimately want to do that is to take, you know, workers' control of the society so we can have that democratic planning. I think public ownership, you know, it doesn't go that far, but it is a step in that direction. And it's one that very sadly, you know, traditional social democratic parties like the Labour Party have given up. But we, you know, can push them and want to, you know, need to push them in that direction. And I just end by saying that, you know, this Sunday night, I'll be speaking, unfortunately, in the middle of the night, Australian time, so not much use for you guys. But, you know, very excited Martin's organised and invited me to speak alongside, you know, other international revolutionaries from Britain, from Ireland, from Turkey, from Ghana, from Brazil. And, you know, we are organized not just here, we are organized around the world. Like, they're having their COP meeting, we're having our international climate conference as well. So I think, you know, there is a huge amount of hope. But global capitalism, you know, connects us as much as it, you know, throws all these problems upon us. It also gives us this amazing technology and these amazing connections and this, you know, power that we've actually never had under any other kind of system that means that we can, you know, build the sort of change we need. I think you've seen in the last, you know, 10 years, movements have become far more globalized, occupied the climate strikes, they spread around the world instantly. And so that's, you know, that's where the hope comes from. And that's, you know, why we need you to join Solidarity to be part of, you know, building that global revolutionary movement for system change, not climate change.